My name is Stacey Stukin. I'm a Los Angeles-based arts and culture journalist, also an investigative journalist. I've covered the wellness and yoga industry for many years. I was a contributing editor at Yoga Journal for about 12 years. And in the course of covering yoga and wellness, 3HO has always been a big component of that space.
Hi, my name is Philip Dieslip. I am a PhD candidate in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. My research mostly revolves around Asian metaphysical and marginal religions in modern America.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Generation Cult, a show about people who grew up in secretive, misunderstood groups, also known as cults, and what happened to them after they left. I'm Deanna, and welcome to the fourth episode of season four. Sometimes we welcome guests on the show who did not grow up in cults themselves, but do deal with subject matter important to people who were impacted by high-demand organizations from a young age. Our two guests today fit into this category. With me today, I have Philip Dieslip, a researcher and writer, along with Stacey Stukin, an LA journalist who covers arts and culture. Philip and Stacey have worked on several articles about a group called 3HO, which stands for Happy, Healthy, Holy Organization. Its guru, Yogi Bhajan, used his own brand of Sikhism to bring Kundalini yoga to the US and formed a bunch of ashrams starting in 1969. You might remember an old episode of Generation Cult way back in season two. This was 2019, and it was our first episode of season two. Our guest, her name is Nirankar, and she grew up in 3HO and was sent to an abusive boarding school in India. The episode is called No Horses in India. We just rebroadcast the episode, so please listen to it because it's pertinent to this particular episode. So in 2020, 3HO finally acknowledged that harm was done to students in these boarding schools, and they created a reparations program to try to address these complaints that were coming out. And these complaints involved sexual, physical abuse, emotional, mental harm. So for several years, this reparations program happened. It ended in December 2023. About 600 survivors filed claims. Philip and Stacey have been covering this situation with 3HO for years, even before this reparations program. It hasn't gotten a ton of attention, but a recent article of theirs, specifically about the boarding schools and the reparations program, came out in a Canadian publication called BOZ. And we're going to be talking to them about their research process, how they got involved in covering this issue, how the organization has handled these allegations of abuse, and the kids who grew up in 3HO and went to these boarding schools, if they feel like the reparations program and how things were settled in December 2023, if they feel like that was effective. So we're going to be talking to them about that today. So welcome, Philip and Stacey. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
I'm curious about how you both found out about 3HO and the conditions of the boarding schools and the children. How did you first become interested in the story that you worked on?
Well, for me, I had been a yoga and wellness journalist for many years, and I had followed 3HO. I had heard rumors about Yogi Bhajan and his sexual misconduct, and I was also very interested in the organization and the businesses they owned and their reach across the country to India in the natural foods business. Cut to the pandemic, a memoir comes out from a former high-ranking official within the organization, and she exposes her abusive, illicit affair with Yogi Bhajan. However, she does not document or talk about the abuses suffered by those born into the organization. But through the course of reporting that story in the spring of 2020, I interviewed a lot of second generation members of 3HO. And it became very clear to me that there was a lot of abuse suffered by these children who were sent to boarding schools in India, often, you know, as young as 5 years old, separated from their parents. And that was kind of my first dive into that part of this much bigger story. And subsequently, as the reparations program began and kicked into gear, Philip and I, who have been collaborating for, as you mentioned, for several years, thought, okay, now's the time to do the story on the second generation.
I first wrote about 3HO back in 2012. I did an article for an academic journal called Sick Formations, where I revealed the actual origins of Yogi Bhajan's Kundalini Yoga. In the course of doing that research, I came across a lot of material that wasn't included in the article. The article only really talked about the yoga and Yogi Bhajan's claims to various titles. One of the people that I spoke with was Nirankar, who you had as a guest on your show. And at that time, Nirankar was kind of like Cassandra. She was a very kind of singular voice, openly talking about the abuse of children within 3HO. I very foolishly thought that that article was going to be the last that I would have to deal with 3HO as a researcher or a writer. And then 8 years later, everything kind of unraveled with the memoir and the pandemic and other people coming forward. And I was contacted by Stacy when she was reporting her article for Los Angeles Magazine. And after her article came out, we realized that the story wasn't going away. And in fact, there's going to be a lot more attention on 3HO. So we kind of made a pinky swear and a pact that we would work together since we had complementary skills. We had a similar outlook about research in the group. So we then began a series of investigative pieces. We wrote a news article for Religion News Service about the third-party report about Yogi Bhajan's abuse. And then twice we've made the very naive decision that we'll just do a little story, that each one is kind of turned into a year of reporting and investigating. We did a piece on the corporate structure of 3HO and how it worked and how Yogi Bhajan built up his empire using the American law's strange deference to religious organizations. And then we had both had a similar sense that perhaps the most important story about 3HO was the story of the men and women who grew up in the group. And that had really not been told. And we also realized that with the reparations program, with more and more people coming forward, that perhaps now was the time to tell that story.
How would you describe 3HO?
I think 3HO is best described as a platypus. Just like a platypus has characteristics of different entities in one body, 3HO is kind of a hybrid organization that part of it revolves around the Sikh religion, another part of it revolves around the practice and the teaching of yoga, and yet another part of it is involved in kind of holistic new age teachings and products like tea. And then there are also some kind of strictly commercial businesses like a security company and everything else. So it's really this kind of strange hybrid group of parts that typically weren't together, but they do coexist in 3HO. I was a part of it my very first week as an undergrad in college. So I did the yoga, I taught the yoga, and I lived in proximity to a few 3HO communities for about a decade. And then in 2008, I began graduate work. And while I was pursuing my master's and developed research chops, I turned my lens onto 3HO and started studying them critically.
Can you tell me a little bit about the guru, Yogi Bhajan?
So Yogi Bhajan comes to the United States in late 1968 via Canada. He's a former customs officer at the New Delhi airport. And when he arrives in Los Angeles, he is quickly assumed to be a spiritual leader and yoga master. So there's some confusion about what his original plans were in the United States, but he very quickly remakes himself into a yoga master and starts teaching what he calls Kundalini yoga to eager hippie students. Yogi Bhajan claims that the yoga he's teaching is very powerful and it's previously secret, but as we know, it's a hodgepodge of various things that he studied as a dilettante back in India. What he quickly does is kind of franchise out his yoga. He sends his students across the country and eventually to Europe to set up their own yoga centers and their own ashrams. So within a year or two, there are centers across the country. And by this time, the organization is known as 3HO, or the Healthy, Happy, Holy Organization. After a kind of chaotic trip to India in late 1970, early 1971, Yogi Bhajan kind of remakes himself as a Sikh religious leader. And he also claims that he is the Mahan Tantric, the singular master of Tantric yoga. And 3HO really takes shape there as this hierarchical structure with Yogi Bhajan at the top and his kind of senior students and ministers beneath him, a kind of national and soon to be international network of centers and ashrams. And 3HO itself has this hybrid teaching of Sikhism combined with yoga, combined with New Age teachings in this all-encompassing prescriptive lifestyle where Yogi Bhajan's teachings govern everything you do, from how you wake up in the morning, how you bathe, how you dress, what you eat, the yoga you do, where you work, your name, who you're married to, when you have sex with the person that you're married to. And as we'll get into, I'm sure, later, these all-encompassing teachings also include how you raise your children and how you interact with your children.
Yes, that's the big, I mean, there's lots of concerns with all of this, but yeah, that was the big concern where I actually first took notice of 3HO because I hadn't heard of them. I mean, I had heard of Kundalini yoga before, but I didn't know about everything else involved. And I don't think a lot of people do. I don't think a lot of people connect it to 3HO. And I first heard about this through Nirankar and the boarding schools and about the ideas that Yogi Bhajan had about parents and children's relationships. I believe it was called distance therapy. Can one of you tell me more about that?
Yes, I can tell you about distance therapy. You know, once people like Nirankar and other sources have said, you know, this kind of child rearing was, they describe it as a child rearing experiment gone horribly wrong. And it was a culmination of practices that started earlier within the community. Yogi Bhajan arranged marriages, and once families started living communally in ashrams and started having children, he told them that these children were special beings. They were saints, sages, and little yogis who were destined to lead humanity and the Khalsa community. He also told the parents that they were too neurotic and ill-equipped to raise their own children. So what initially happens is something called child swapping. Children is toddlers, 17-month-old, you know, babies are sent to live with other families in other cities far away from their families of origin. And for many, this starts years of not having bonding time with their families. And then ultimately, it gets more extreme when they decide to send the children to India. And that comes from another idea that Yogi Bhajan had, or at least that's what he told the parents, that not only were they too screwed up to raise their children, American society was going to be detrimental as well. Too much sex, drugs, violence, not spiritual enough. So by sending the children to India, closer to the heart of Sikhi, that this would be yet another way to create these enlightened beings that could help lead humanity.
Yeah, to jump in there, to bring both of our pieces for Baz News together, in the mid to late 1970s, Yogi Bhajan has set up a kind of corporate structure for 3HO in which he has singular control over the assets of his followers. So his followers give their homes, their inheritances, a tenth of their earnings to the religion. But Yogi Bhajan is the only person who has complete control of those assets. So as we mentioned in our first piece for Boz, he has direct control, whether it's material or spiritual or psychological, over everyone. You know, your job is at 3HO. Your marriage was arranged by him. Your spouse believes that he's, you know, God's messenger on earth. But he is also putting forth these ideas. He calls it the coming insanity, that not only is America collapsing, but like we're in for gigantic cataclysmic changes. So it's really this kind of two-punch combo for families in 3HO. You have little control over your own life, and you have these ideas constantly pushed on you that the end is near, America is close to collapse. And so in this kind of echo chamber, sending your kids to India seems to make sense to a lot of them.
Okay, so fast forward to 2020. So people start coming forward with accusations regarding the boarding schools, or it sounds like it wasn't just the boarding schools. It was 3HO in general. Is that correct?
Well, in regards to the second generation, the majority of the stories that came out were talking about surviving the terrible conditions and treatment at the boarding schools. But simultaneously, there are women coming forward telling their stories of harm at the hands of Yogi Bhajan, some of them who are second generation members.
And there's also abuse that's happening at 3HO ashrams within the United States, at summer camps held by 3HO in the United States. So there really is abuse of children from top to bottom, both in the US and in India. So a lot of the things that we heard of, you know, well, that was India, or that was early on, or, you know, there were a few bad apples. It's really difficult to find any significant pocket of 3HO and not find the abuse and neglect and mistreatment of children there.
A lot of this stuff was known before 2020. Yeah. Nirankar posted on her Rishi Knott's blog, you know, I think 17 years ago. So there was that documentation. There was a group of young girls that were abused at the boarding school. Their mothers knew and tried to get recourse within the organization. Not successfully, but they tried. So 2020, there may have been this kind of public community reckoning because everyone was on Zoom. I mean, the way it was described to us, that they finally got the space to tell those stories and to tell them in a public setting where everybody heard them, family, peers. And then that started the difficult conversations between families, peers, and the organization.
That was one thing that struck me about the whole thing. It seemed like it had just been this open secret for decades, basically, that all the stuff had been happening, but just no one was doing anything about it.
Yeah.
From reading your stories, it seemed like finally, maybe 2020 was some turning point where finally there was this like push to actually take action. But it's actually pretty mind-blowing to me that this had gone on for so long with so many people knowing about it and just nothing had been done. When did the schools even start?
Well, the first group of kids went to India in 1981.
Yeah, it's been going on a while.
But there were children's ashrams as early as around 1973. That's also when there's open dialogue within 3HO about the necessity of sending children to India. So it really is, you know, from the outset, as soon as 3HO members start having children, these ideas about how to raise those children are there. And I think another important piece of the puzzle is that there were many parents and families who left over the decades, specifically because of the treatment of children and the treatment of children at the boarding schools. And Stacy and I have used a shorthand. We call it divorce 3HO style. You know, if you are in 3HO and you want to divorce your spouse or leave, it's a good bet that the organization will throw its resources behind the parent who decides to stay. So that decision to leave is often very difficult. And there are numerous parents who leave 3HO without their children. And 3HO is very adept at using claims of religious belief and religious expression to keep children within the group, to keep loyal spouses with custody of their children. But again, it points back to it being an open secret. There are many people who leave because of the treatment of children. There are many aspects of the abuse and neglect of children that are open and in your face. And I think another difficult dynamic that is also important to mention is, especially the boarding schools in the 90s, it's a culture of abuse. And it's very difficult for people to go through such a system and not feel some guilt or complicity. And so that is part of that culture of silence. You know, when Narankar and a few others start talking about abuse in the boarding schools, there's a lot of pushback from not just the organization and parents, but also peers. There's a lot of secrets that people are afraid are going to come out. So there really is this kind of dam that is building up to burst in 2020, but it takes a very long time for it to reach that point.
So yeah, so take me through this. When this actually became public and something actually happened, what were some of the accusations that were made that were finally addressed as far as 3HO went?
Well, we can talk about the conditions at the boarding school, for example, cases of medical neglect, children not getting the kind of health care they needed, and many of those injuries or conditions continue to cause them problems today. Physical abuse, sexual abuse, lack of food. You know, you have kids having to bring toilet paper with them, having to clean their own clothes, losing weight, getting poor food, getting sick from the food, and poor infrastructure and not a great education. And actually, a big part of the education is Kundalini yoga and meditation.
3HO had a series of boarding schools in India starting from the early 1980s. Some of them were pre-existing boarding schools where 3HO kind of was attached to them in their own kind of separate school within a school. The first one is GNFC, Guru Nanak Fifth Centenary. Then that moves to another boarding school in northern India, Guru Ram Dass Academy. There are several transitional years in Amritsar. And then 3HO has Miri Piri Academy, its own boarding school in Amritsar starting in the mid-late 1990s. So there are these different schools, these different places, but there are problems that are kind of consistent throughout. As Stacey mentioned, you know, lack of food, lack of healthcare, abusive staff, both Indian and 3HO, who are committing a range of abuses, physical assaults, sexual abuse, psychological abuse. That continues at Miri Piri Academy, but one kind of important change is that when you have that boarding school, you start to have the revolving door where students who graduate Miri Piri, they're not prepared to go to college. They're not encouraged to join the outside world. So they often just come right back to Miri Piri without credentials, without a college education, without outside experience. So as several people told us, you have the weird irony of someone who's 2 years older than you, who is just in the graduating class, is now your teacher, is now your guide. But instead of credentials or experience or college degrees, often what justifies people leading the school is simply that they went through it, that they are, you know, pro Yogi Bhajan, they accept the way things are. So you really have this kind of revolving door and really kind of institutionalized abuse where hazing, bullying, cruelty just become business as usual, just how things are done. It's the Miri Piri way. And I think probably one of the most kind of shocking bits of evidence for this is from 3HO itself. You know, they had a long kind of promotional video about their boarding school. I think it's still available on YouTube. And the staff themselves are saying this. They are openly saying, I didn't know what to do. I wasn't prepared. I was tough. We had to instill grit in the students. You know, a lot of these claims of abuse are really open secrets, and they're mentioned by 3HO themselves.
And that was by design in ways. The headline of our recent piece is, you know, 3H boarding schools, you know, were a living hell. I mean, that came from a direct quote from Yogi Bhajan, which I will paraphrase. He said, you know, these schools are a living hell, and I like it because that's, wow, we're going to create independent, strong people with grit who can survive anything. If they can survive this living hell, they can survive anything.
Three HO actually created a committee to deal with everything that was coming out about all these complaints about the school.
It's the IHRC, the Independent Healing and Reparations Committee. So 3HO creates a reparations program to handle these various claims of abuse. And this is a new kind of entity, these reparations programs. They're really only coming out in significant numbers over the last 5 or so years. So traditionally, survivors would sue an organization in like a lawsuit or like a larger class action. So people would typically, survivors would typically try to get restitution by filing a lawsuit or a class action lawsuit in large numbers. A reparations claim is really a private agreement that is reached by a group of survivors and the organization themselves. It's a private agreement that's then enforced by the courts. So optimistically, they're described as a way for survivors to get reparations, to get some kind of justice without having to go through a lengthy and re-traumatizing court battle. What these programs also do is they allow organizations to settle claims without having to go to court, without being compelled to show evidence, and without people having to testify under oath. And in this case with 3HO, as in many others, when survivors receive their settlements, they sign away their right to sue the organization. So a very cynical take on these programs, and one that we heard from many people regarding 3HO's reparation program, is that it makes a problem go away. You get a large number of people who, in theory, could sue the organization, and you shrink it down dramatically. And several of the experts that we talked to in reporting this piece said that many states are rolling back their statutes of limitation. So in many cases, people thought this happened 20, 30 years ago, I could no longer sue. Suddenly, these events are back in play. So California, New York State, and I believe Maryland all rolled back these statutes of limitation. So if you're an organization that has a history of abuse, it is very timely and it's very relevant that you would want to settle these claims to kind of nullify the potential threat that could be coming your way.
So it looks like, as in 3HO's case, it looks like they're saying, oh, we're so sorry, we want to work this out, but it's really kind of a way of making it go away.
Yes. I mean, yes, it's an efficient way to deal with a lot of claims at once, avoid lawsuits and discovery within a court system. The benefit to the claimants is that they don't have to go through a long re-traumatizing court case, and perhaps the harm they suffered, there's no statute or no recourse within the court system unless it's, you know, a civil suit. And again, you have the same issues of paying for a lawyer and doing all of that. But I think from our reporting, this process, which was presented as a trauma-informed, that it would be a trauma-informed process that would not only address, you know, monetary reparations for future healing and repair, but also address non-monetary requests. And in many cases, the non-monetary requests were much more important to claimants than getting money. And those were things like institutional change, safeguards, perhaps apologies requested from specific people, maybe just having the organization actually apologize itself. So there were various individual claims that people requested, but as far as we can tell, little to few of them have been met.
The non-ones.
The financial ones, and that the financial ones are another issue as well. I mean, you know, there was a set amount of money. We were able to confirm in our reporting that the organization put aside a set amount of money with the expectation that they might receive maybe 100, 120 claims. They get close to 600 claims. Requests are made to increase that sum of money because the other misrepresentation was that there would be no cap to the amount of money that the independent administrators that were assigned to determine the amount paid out. They could give as much as they saw fit. Well, it turned out there was a cap because there was a set amount of money. And so that had to stretch further to the 600 claimants.
Do you think that this was effective? The people you interviewed who were involved in this whole process, do you think that they felt in any way satisfied by this reparations program?
It was effectively awful. None of the survivors that we spoke to described the program with any sense of completion or satisfaction. In fact, most of the people that we spoke to described the reparations program as another form of abuse. Some of them said that they were left in a position that was noticeably worse than before it began, because not only was it re-traumatizing and ineffective, but it gave them little, if anything. You know, many people wanted apologies, or they wanted some kind of truth and reconciliation report, or they wanted some kind of safeguarding, known abusers to not be allowed near children or to be reprimanded, or for those cases to be brought to police, or to receive some kind of financial settlement that would allow people the ability to heal, the ability to go back to school or take time off work. None of those things really happened. The amounts of money that people received, from our understanding, was a fraction, a tiny fraction of what they expected and what you would expect from comparable cases. The only real entity that kind of comes out on top of this whole process is 3HO itself, which shrunk its liability, shrunk the number of potential threats to it dramatically.
I got the chance to catch up a little bit with Narankar, one of the people who grew up in 3HO being sent to one of these boarding schools in India, and who also participated in this reparations program. She didn't have a lot of great things to say about the experience as well.
There seemed to be, like, no matter how fair it all seemed, no matter how restorative it could be in the end, there were cultish aspects. And it's kind of like corporate cult, corporate-y kind of talk, corporate mumbo jumbo word salad stuff that you can't pick apart because it's too much. I would say it started out messy. It was hard to get my peers on like a sort of a page of like, plant your feet firmly on the ground, say what you need to say, be a part of it, not because it's good or bad, but because we're trying to reach a place that might go past our generation. It might help people beyond us. We don't know that for sure, but we have to see something in it bigger than ourselves. I actually was someone who spoke in out, like on, you know, among the community, spoke very encouragingly to be a part of the reparations program, because there's almost like this like collective freak out of like, no fucking way. And then kind of like, well, if it's like that, then you're back at zero. They put thousands of us traumatized people in a hallway together, and we're all just like scrambling for the door, and it was chaos for a bit. I think it was a difficult tightrope to walk because I don't trust the institution, but I was like, you still have to participate.
How do you feel about the outcome?
The outcome is pathetic, period. It's pathetic. My final conversation with one of my lawyers at Justice Law Collaborative went like this. So this is pathetic. We know it's not enough. We don't think you should turn away anything, though. And at the same time, if you do want to turn down your offer and take it to something like mediation, or turn it down altogether and choose what you want to do, if you choose mediation, the law firm representing 3HO, they will pull you in and cross-examine your every word. They will cast doubt on your character, your motivations, your past, your everything. They'll put you through hell. And then you won't have any more than if you just signed right now. So it's not like a coerced sign, but it's a, we all know none of us want to go through that. We also all know that it's about resources, right? Like, they have the resources to extend this as long as they want. And that's what big corporations do. They use their resources to stall. And so that was like another way of saying, we're going to stall this even longer and you're going to feel 10 times worse after this is over. So it's sort of like that weighing of like, I've already lost like my core self in all of this. Like, I've already gotten like back into this cesspool of insanity. And then they're saying they're going to cross-examine me and they're going to go over everything. And so me being someone with podcasts and blogs and photos and social media and everything, I'm like, well, I can see the framing already. And I think it was so simple right then and there. I'm like, forget it. We're done.
Now back to Philip and Stacey.
I mean, I also think the people we interviewed, this idea of a document that would give an overview of what happened and the abuses that were suffered, that was super important. And that was part of the idea of transparency. And, you know, that was something that was promised as well, that there was a man that was tasked with taking all the claims, creating a report, anonymizing it, and then presenting it so the whole community and public could see what happened. That has not, as far as we know, been compiled or released. And whether or not he has submitted his recommendations for change there, we do not know, because neither Mary Peary would talk to us, the people who ran the program wouldn't speak with us, 3HO didn't speak with us. I mean, our reporting is solid and it's accurate, but not with the assistance of the organization letting us know what their intention are or even acknowledging harm.
Yeah, there was also an election for the Siri Singsab Corp, the kind of governing body last year, that, as many people described to us, it brought the hardliners and the fanatics and the deniers of abuse into positions of power. And that has, in the subsequent months, that has really kind of changed the tenor of the organization. So, you know, this kind of governing body populates the boards beneath it. And if you look at 3HO now, it's back to where it was 5 years ago, perhaps even more dramatically. So all of these kind of temporary hand-wringing apologetic measures, some kind of statement of sadness or solidarity, removing of Yogi Bhajan's name and picture from websites, all that's gone. 3HO is back, just like it was before all of this came out. So in addition to there not being many of the things that were offered during this reparations program, I think this is kind of the insult to injury.
So it's not just that it wasn't effective, it's that it's even worse. It made it look like it might be better. Oh, you care, you might do something. And instead, it sounds like it almost regressed in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the lessons that, I won't speak for Stacey, but I'll say for myself personally, one of the lessons I took from our year reporting this piece is to have zero trust in any kind of trauma-informed or social justice language. It's put up or shut up. Show the demonstrable, clear results or actions, and that's the only thing that matters.
Yes.
Because it really seems that one of the things that allowed this program to happen the way it did was that kind of language, mm-hmm. to use trauma-informed language, to use social justice language. This is restorative justice. This is all of these things. But when you look at the reality of it, it was allowing abusers to go unpunished and survivors to move forward uncompensated and unrecognized.
I certainly agree with that. And within that purge, there were also members of the second generation that were still involved with the organization who really had all the best intention to help heal the community and have the truth and reconciliation. And they were bullied, harassed, and left as well.
I think one particularly bleak way to look at the last 4 years within 3HO and the reparations program is, in a way, one last time for the first gen of 3HO to ignore the suffering of their children. At the end of the day, the most important thing is to show respect and obedience to the organization.
So what is the response been to your story?
I think within the second generation, at least the people we've spoken to, I think that they looked at this story as an opportunity for us to tell their stories and to tell what happened with the reparation program and to document their dissatisfaction with it, the idea that it was a bait and switch. From within the organization or from current and former members, there's a bit of a stunned silence. You know, when we were reporting the piece, the thing that was really striking to me in particular was the first generation's reluctance to go on the record. You know, mothers who I have spoken to over the years who said it was very difficult for them to suppress their maternal urges and that they had great grief and regret about how they raised their children and sent them to India. Only one of them would go on the record. And we were very grateful that a woman was able to admit the harm and to admit her regret. But a lot of it is very easy. And Philip and I talk about this a lot when you're talking about institutional abuse. It's very easy to lay the blame at the feet of Yogi Bhajan, but there were many, many people along the way for many, many years who enabled the harm to continue. And that includes mandatory reporters. That includes nurses, counselors, ministers, people who knew that children were being abused, who had the ethical and legal responsibility to report this harm. And they did not.
In some ways, I think putting a focus on the leader is important and it's part of the puzzle. But as many people told us, you would not have 3HO if it was just Yogi Bhajan. It took a lot of people to create the organization, to support it, to carry out his mandates. And on his own, Yogi Bhajan wasn't even necessarily that charismatic. It took lots of people beneath him to kind of reinforce his charisma or convince other people of him. So in some ways, that kind of typical description of 3HO as a cult and Yogi Bhajan as, you know, an abusive tyrant, however true those may be, it's not the full story. And it also seems to be a way to avoid the responsibility that many people had.
Do you think that that's maybe one reason this was able to remain so silent and why, even though you guys have written about this multiple times, it hasn't been as publicized?
I mean, my own personal take is that a lot of the coverage of cults might not be sensationalistic, but it doesn't want to go to the aspects of a lot of stories which are just bleak and cannot be entertaining. I think people can kind of get this voyeuristic thrill looking at groups like NXIVM or Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh and, you know, its outfits and its unusual sex and its weird costumes. But you really can't have that kind of voyeuristic charge when you're talking about the abuse of children. It is so heavy. It is so bleak. And maybe that's part of it.
Yeah.
I mean, the other thing is when I did my original story for Los Angeles Magazine and I interviewed Philip, one of the things I kept asking a similar question, how did this go on for so long? You know, how did nobody know? And then subsequently reporting our piece for Boz, I think there's two things going on. 3HO, see, Dharma is a religion. So, you know, religions in the United States get a pass, right? So they can kind of fly under the radar. We're Sikhs. We're practicing Sikhi. Also, the values of Sikhi and the values that 3HO were presenting in public facing was hardworking, family values, cozy homes, vegetarian cooking, healthy, yoga, meditation. They weren't, you know, hippies freaking out on acid. They were conservative families, and that aligns with American values too. So for a very long time, they could kind of glide along culturally within that space of both religion and family values.
So do you think anything more is going to come of this? What do you see going forward?
The thing that I would like to see, and Philip and I have discussed figuring out ways to cover 3HO in a way that would illuminate this, is that so people can make the connection between Kundalini Yoga, which is very popular, and the institutional abuse suffered by the children born into the organization and the families who suffered various other kinds of spiritual and financial abuse along the way. And yogi tea. So any of your listeners out there that drink yogi tea, that is a business that is owned by 3HO. You know, the yoga has continued to proliferate, but it's a little sneaky. I can think of a couple of teachers off the top of my head that are very popular. They don't necessarily name it as Kundalini Yoga. That's exactly what they're doing.
You know, you can make the argument that the continued use of the yoga and the patronizing of the organization allows for a system of teachings and an organization that abused children in the past to continue. But there's also the insult to injury. As we now know, there are hundreds and hundreds of survivors out there. And at the very least, to continue to promote the yoga that terrorized their youth, it's re-traumatizing to them and it's insulting. One woman that I interviewed, she talked about being on vacation and trying to like handle all these things that had come up. And while she's in a remote part of the world in Central America, she comes across another tourist who out of nowhere starts babbling to her about this wonderful new yoga that she's been doing. And has she ever heard of it? It's called Kundalini Yoga. And, you know, as she told me, she was like, couldn't fucking believe it. In the middle of nowhere, this stuff is still in my face and coming at me. But I mean, I think that's kind of a sobering kind of conclusion that you can reach. I think there are two things, you know, for an organization like 3HO to continue, all they need is to have new people who are willing to join, to patronize it, to go through teacher training programs. And the other thing is that there really does seem to be a strong resistance within yoga, wellness, new age culture for people to look beyond themselves. So many people openly say, but it's my experience. I get some good out of it. The idea that there would be some kind of ethical barrier for people to do a form of yoga made up by a serial rapist or to give their money to an organization that covered up the systemic abuse of hundreds of children, we may think that there's that kind of ethical barrier, but I think not really so much in that world.
Well, thank you for covering it. And thank you for talking to me about this today. Is there anything else that you think our listeners should know about your coverage or about this issue?
I think at the present moment, it's important to note that there are pending lawsuits against the organization. There's a woman named Sunny Khalsa who's had a lawsuit slowly making its way through court for several years. There's a group of four women who rejected reparations in order to sue the organization. So there is some activity against the organization and on behalf of survivors. I wouldn't be surprised if there were more lawsuits that were coming in the near future. But also, sadly, it's very much business as usual.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you again for your time.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thanks. Thank you.
We'll leave you with some closing thoughts by Narankar.
A lot of people just became so shattered, and it's going to take a lot for them to pick themselves up and put themselves back together again. And I don't know. I mean, I feel like I kind of came unraveled too during this whole process. It felt like I was getting pulled back into a cult.